Hello, everybody, and welcome to Minute 105 of Season 5 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today to finish off this week is Travis Bowe of the Watchmen Minute. Welcome back, Travis.
Thank you.
Great to have you back. Hopefully you've been enjoying this week as much as I have. And hopefully the listeners are awesome. That's probably more important. Well, yeah. I don't know. Depends on how you want to look at it. Sometimes it's good that we're at least having a good time too. You know, because
yeah,
you know, if
I'm
we don't
a good time,
so. If we don't have a good time, then for sure the listeners won't. You know, those are hard things to get through when the hosts are not having a good time.
Yeah.
So. All right, so minute 105 begins with John trying to think of a solution and ends with John opening the door of the chopper. So we ended things yesterday with John starting to get a little bit disturbed because, you know, he sees that the plane has left the hangar, but he at the same time, he actually is hearing that Holly's plane is having a lot of trouble and could possibly be about to crash, possibly. So, yeah, he wants to make sure that he's able to figure something out.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of his ideas, the pilot keeps basically shooting down saying, no, I'm not going to do that. No, not going to do that. So that's not simple for John. He's right now got a one-track mind. He wants to save Holly.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, that is the main thing that we understand about John from the first two movies is he will do anything to help Holly. And then in the third movie, they just completely changed that.
Yeah.
That's just gone.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, forget about that. I don't care about her.
Right.
You know, but in the first two movies, his main goal is to save Holly. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons also why it makes John feel so common to all of us. You know, that we can yeah. understand what he's doing because he's not doing it to save the country. He's not doing it. He's doing it to save his wife. That's what it comes down to.
Sure.
Everything that he's doing, obviously there are, you know, repercussions of him helping others at the same time. But his main goal is to help Holly. And I like that aspect of him.
John's the type of person that in the first movie, if he was just in that building and Holly wasn't there and everything went down, I think, you know, he would do the same thing. You know, he would, you know, and this situation, if, you know, I just think he's going to do what he can to stop, you know, the bad guys. I agree that, you know, Holly being here is motivating, you know, his intensity, but I think he would help.
Having Holly there gives him more motivation. So yeah, it's exactly what you were thinking there. So John just thinks of an idea and he goes, all right, how about getting over top of it? You know, and the pilot seems to maybe agree with that. You know,
right.
It's a little bit more of an idea. I don't really know what it really will do for John, but okay. That's what he wants to do. All right, we'll let him do it.
Yeah. Bruce Willis is really good at this sort of acting where you can tell he's making a decision to go do something crazy. Like you can see that he's searching for, you know, a plan, something to do. And the only thing he can think of is, you know, jumping down onto this plane. So, he's so good at doing all that just with his face. You know, you can tell that he's coming up with something, some plan. I think throughout this franchise, he does this a lot.
Yeah.
Probably in other, you know, of course in other movies as well, but in these types of movies that he does where he's got to take action, he acts that well. I don't think everyone could do that necessarily. And I also started to think about, like, in this situation, you know, John McClane walked so Jack Bauer could run. Kind of one of those things. Like, it feels very much like if this was 24, you know, the difference would be that Jack Bauer would just pull a gun out and threaten to shoot the pilot. In the, you know, effort to stop the bad guys, you know, but.
Right. Okay. I think that makes sense.
It's good that John doesn't go that far.
That's true. Did you ever see the parody of 24 of, you know, the, I think they call it the original pilot of 24 from 1990, where you see a guy who's because there were no cell phones. So he's trying to, you know, use a rotary phone in order to call people. And, you know, he has to connect to the internet, and he has the, you know, the static of, you know, the way that we all used to connect to the internet, where you have all
the modem
for the modem and stuff like that. So yeah, it's just it's you should check that out on YouTube. It's actually pretty funny because it shows how technology was so different and it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah,
you know. then we're back to the shot of we're back on the plane itself. You can obviously see that this is a model of the Northeast Air plane. I mean, one of the things that Renny Harlin mentions on the commentary is that the cargo plane that we saw beforehand and we'll see at the end of this minute again is the only real plane that they use. You know, the rest of the planes are all models. You know, and they
I think this one looks pretty good.
Yeah, it looks pretty good. You know, this isn't Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which steals the shot from Airplane. You know, they stole the model from there. So the pilot once again gets on the speaker. We actually see him. The first thing I like is we see that the co-pilot is putting his seatbelt on. You know, realizing at this point, okay, we need to do something. And then you mentioned earlier in the week that Thomas Everett Scott is here. Tom Everett Scott. And so you see him in the back as the navigator, and like he ruffles his hand through his hair, you know,
he's stressed. Yeah.
Completely. And then the pilot gets on the speaker and goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain. Your attention. We have no choice but to attempt an emergency landing." And I love the way he says attempt. We're going to attempt it.
Yeah.
It might not work, but we're going to try. Yeah. "Please fasten your seatbelts and assume crash positions as instructed by your cabin attendants." And then he turns to the co-pilot and goes, "Let's have the emergency checklist." So I got to give them credit for the fact that they have an emergency checklist, because, I mean, like, we know that they have a pre-flight checklist and stuff like that. You know, we know that from movies and stuff like that. But usually when you're in an emergency, you don't have time to go through a checklist.
Yeah. I looked into emergency landings and that sort of thing, and I did find one article that talked about there was a situation, I forget exactly where they were coming in from and where they had to divert to, but they got on the radio and said, okay, we can – the plane may have taken off right away and then noticed, okay, we've got a problem. We're going to do an emergency landing. So they start going through their – emergency checklist, and the people on the radio said, "Well, this runway is clear. Just go ahead and land it." You know, and the pilot said that they said, "We're not going to take this immediate runway. We're going to continue with our emergency checklist. Check all these boxes. Go through the emergency procedure as we're supposed to, not just take the quickest route to land." So I guess in a situation like this, maybe it for, you know, and this article then said, it was actually will tie into, another bit that I have, but, the person saying all this was, John Cox, a retired airline pilot captain, who flew for 45 years. And said that pilot made the right call. Like it was right to go through all those, through the steps, not just land immediately.
But you don't always have that option.
of course. Yeah. Not in every situation. But then the other thing that I was looking up that led me to that was, like I said, this John Cox, retired airline captain who flew for US Airways. I was looking up how often emergency landings happen, and he said emergency landings happen more than many of us would like to think. In 45 years of aviation, Cox said he has made between 10 and 15 emergency landings, And in case you were wondering, no one was injured and no damage was reported to any of the aircraft in the emergency landings that Cox had to perform. And then so it was hard to find. I was hoping to find, on average, how many emergency landings are there a year? I couldn't really find that number. I found a lot of sources saying that Heathrow Airport makes one emergency landing every day.
Wow.
And then other articles saying that's BS, so I don't know. It was impossible to find a reliable source that would, give me a good number. Wow. So.
Okay. Well, I actually looked it up also a little bit and I found different information.
Okay.
I found complimentary information, I guess you can say. So first of all, the airport that apparently has the highest number of emergency landings is Shannon Airport in Ireland, because you have all the planes that are coming, the transatlantic flights that if they need to make an emergency landing is there. A few months ago, we had a story from Jim O'Kane about the time that he was on a plane that made an emergency landing into Shannon, and they told him 2 hours beforehand that they were on their way to make this emergency landing. So you can go back and listen to episode 48 of this season was when Jim was on and told that story in what happened to him in 1990, the summer of 1990. That's what it was. So one of the things another thing that I found was that there are three main types of emergency landings. There's what's known as a forced landing, where you have to make a landing due to some sort of technical problem and you have to land as soon as possible, no matter where. It doesn't really make a difference. That's why it's forced, because the aircraft probably can't continue to go any further. Then you have what's known as a precautionary landing, where you have a landing set at a particular location, but there's information that you're missing. Sometimes it could be that there's a problem with the aircraft or some medical or a police emergency or something like that. And therefore, they don't necessarily have time to check the potential landing site, going basically to the story that you just told, where you or even in this situation, where these Northeast pilots have to make this landing. So it's probably a precautionary landing because their instruments aren't working properly either. And then the third kind is known as is ditching, and it's very similar to a forced landing, but it's usually done on water. Obviously the most famous of those is, any clue?
Oh yeah, the 1495 or something like that.
1549. You're very close.
Landing on the Hudson.
You got the numbers right. Okay. You just flipped them around a little bit. 1549. The Sully landing on the Hudson is probably the most
that one came famous up. One. Yeah, that one came up quite a bit in the little bit of research I did. So that's why those numbers were in my head.
Great. That works well. And then the co-pilot gets on. We hear him say, "Attention all traffic on this frequency in Dulles area. This is Northeast 140. We're going to attempt an emergency landing. Be advised." Again, attempt. These guys are not very confident in what they're doing.
Yeah. I like that he calls them cabin attendants. I don't recall ever hearing cabin attendants.
Yes.
Yeah. In reference to...
That's right. I think earlier in the movie, he refers to them as flight attendants, and there are times when they're referred to also here as stewardesses. So, that was back in the day, I guess, when you could refer to people. You could refer to them that way. Nowadays, you risk the chance of offending. So you need to be careful what you say.
Because what do we use now? Flight attendants?
I believe so, yes.
That's the more... Yes. Yeah.
I think that is the more PC... use of it instead of a steward or a stewardess. And then the shot changes and we see Holly, then we see the old woman, and then it goes back into the cockpit. They show the two flight attendants carrying or escorting Thornburg back to his seat. And he goes, I don't want to die.
Yeah.
I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And if you look really carefully at second 28, you see this blonde woman who's like sitting next to the window. And she looks totally in shock about the fact that they're bringing Thornburg in this way. You know,
she looks pleased. It looks like she's smiling. Oh my gosh, that's, you know,
that's Richard Thornburg.
Richard Thornburg, you know, like completely ignoring the message, you know, from the captain, and she's happy that's to right. see. The guy, I keep looking at the guy further back in the plane, looks like another kind of character actor. He looks like Philip Baker Hall.
Oh yeah,
guy from.
Yeah,
you know, Magnolia and a bunch of other stuff. But,
yeah, I don't think it's him.
No, I don't think it's him.
And I love how they belt him in. The two of them, they need, you know, how many flight attendants does it take to buckle in Thornburg? You know, the answer is two. You know, it sounds like the punchline of a joke.
Thornburg, William Atherton goes in this like one shot. Does some of like the best acting I've seen in this movie and the worst acting, like all in this one kind of sequence. when they're guiding him to his seat and he says, I'm sorry. I genuinely get the feeling that Richard Thornburg is, you know, absolutely sorry for what he's done, for this panic that he's caused, that, you know, but then like once they get him seated and everything, he does this weird physical acting where he kind of flops forward and throws his arms on the seat in front of him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and puts his head down. And it's just terrible, like physical acting that doesn't work for me.
It's just too much. But then the biggest question is what does getting hit by a taser do to you? Is it supposed to make you start feeling remorseful? Is that the right. the idea here? You know. So I actually found an article that talks about 10 different ways that a taser or a stun gun can damage your body.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it goes through a list of the different things that so the first thing is it can make your muscles seize up like a Charlie horse. So that obviously could hurt, and that could sort of be what Thornburg is experiencing here.
Yeah.
It they say that it could make your like brain feel like it is shaking like a peanut in a jar.
Wow.
Because it's going so fast. And the people claim that it does hurt a lot. I don't want to ever have to find out what it feels like. So,
right.
You know, I'll take their word for it. they say that it could theoretically affect your heart and your heart rate, depending on, you know, how much, which again makes sense because it is some sort of, it is a type of defibrillator, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
There have been deaths from people getting hit by tasers. Usually they have heart attacks because of this. They can sometimes temporarily affect memory and cognition. It could be emotionally or psychologically jarring and could cause trauma to the person, which again, maybe that's what Thornburg is going through here. You know, some sort of... Yeah. Feeling of trauma.
Yeah.
If they have probes that are sharp on, I mean, obviously here they didn't use, a stun gun with their probes.
Yeah.
They can lead to puncture wounds, scrapes, bruises, things like that. Stun guns can also severely harm kidney function. So yeah, I guess you need to be careful about that. Not that you really have a choice, but that's something that could happen. The last two are actually very interesting. You know, some of them is just that you remain sore for a few days after the fact.
Probably because your muscles tensing up.
That's right, because your pain receptors and nerve endings are overstimulated.
Wow.
Okay, and the most damaging thing that could happen is electric shocks sometimes have caused what's known as testicular torsion.
Okay.
Basically, twisting your testicles around.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's something that theoretically could hurt a lot also. So, the idea is not to get stunned by a stun gun or a taser. But, it's something that could theoretically happen. So you need to be careful about
those. The only way to win is by not playing.
There you go. That is true. You know, we just hear the two stewardesses saying to Thornburg, just buckle your seatbelt. And he goes, I'm sorry. You're going to be all right now. Lean forward now. Thank you, God. Oh, God. And then it's very strange because, like, we get a shot of Holly and we can actually hear she, like, crosses herself. And then she starts praying. You know, she says, oh, God, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. So, you know, she's showing how religious she can be.
Yeah, or at least reciting, I think, is it the 23rd Psalm where that comes from, I think. And it almost feels like she's paraphrasing, like she's not.
It comes right after, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Again, I'm familiar with this in a different language, so, you know, I never think about that from that perspective. But yes, thy rod and thy staff comfort me.
I typically only, like, I get most of my religion through movies and pop culture. And so I've heard the 23rd Psalm enough in movies and stuff. And then, like, going to weddings or funerals, like, at a church, they'll often do the 23rd Psalm,
right.
You know, depending on, you know.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yes, you are correct.
The rod and staff are definitely standout, you know, terms. So
right, that's true. I'm trying to think of what it is in Hebrew from that one, but whatever. I'm the only one who would understand if I were to say it anyway. So it doesn't make a difference. I mean, I know it. I'm familiar with it. I do know it by heart, but it's not something that I like right now while we're talking. I can just quickly switch and say it.
Sure.
Whatever. So then the shot changes and we get the chopper once again, and we see that it's getting closer to the cargo plane. And then we see that John starts opening the door. And at this point, he goes, hang on. Which is just very, very strange. The whole idea that no one else knows that this is what his plan is.
Yeah.
You know, they're just a little shocked about this whole thing, about what he's planning on doing. And on Monday, we'll talk a little bit more about what's going on, what's going on inside of the helicopter as they're doing this. Now, one of the things that I find really interesting is that beforehand, you know, we were talking about the fact that with Thornburg and then with Holly. So you see a whole bunch of different passengers and how they all are getting into the brace position and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I read something very interesting that apparently there was a rumor that the whole idea of the crash positions is a conspiracy theory. And
right. I have the same thing, I think.
It's an urban legend that it is ineffective at stopping injuries or deaths, and that the actual intention behind its adoption is to be able to kill passengers in crashes, either to ensure a painless death, preserve the remains, or to avoid lawsuits. And apparently both Mythbusters and Snopes have debunked it, and also many aviation personnel. But if the aviation personnel are part of the conspiracy theory, obviously they're also going to say that they're going to debunk it. So, you know.
Yep, I had that as well.
All right, great. So you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
No, that's it. I'm good.
Great. So in the script, it starts with McLean is furious, but the pilot is equally tough. Remember, we started with the fact that the pilot refused to get in front of the plane. And then McLean goes, okay, then how about on top of it? As both men realize they've cut a dangerous deal and start to smile, we cut to Holly's plane. The pilot and co-pilot look at each other as their fuel gauge beeps and flashes yellow. Then the pilot says into the intercom, ladies and gentlemen, our situation is critical. The cabin attendants are lugging Thornburg's unconscious body down the aisle. They strap him in as Holly and the others listen, chilled to the pilot's voice. We have no choice but to attempt an emergency landing. Please put on your safety belts and assume crash positions as instructed by the cabin attendants. The plane engine is glowing through the snow. And then it says, then Holly on the plane, yea, though I walk through the valley of death. To her amazement, she hears other voices mumbling tearfully. It's Thornburg, half conscious. And then it says, Thornburg says, I didn't mean any harm. I just wanted ratings. I had to do it. It was sweeps week.
Jeez.
Seriously. And then they cut that, and that's it. That's the end of the thing from the script. Mm-hmm. So Every Friday, I have a segment called Where Are They Up To This Weekend? Where basically what I decided to do was, some of my guests are Movies by Minute, people who have Movies by Minute podcasts. So I decided to, I figured out a way that I'm going to start testing their memory to see how good they know the movies that they've done minute by minute.
Okay.
So right now we've reached the point where we've hit the 1 hour and 45 minute mark of this movie. So okay. The question is for you then, Travis, is since you've done the Watchmen minute, what is going on in Watchmen at the hour and 45 minute mark, approximately? Man. Again, you know, and again, I used the director's cut. So, you know,
yep.
So
what, 186 what minutes. So that means we've got like 40 minutes left of the movie. So I'm going to put us in.
No, what do you mean? You have a lot more than 40 minutes. This is an hour and 45 minutes. It's 105 minutes.
Oh, I was thinking.
Okay. No, I know. I understood.
So minute 105.
Minute 105, right, correct.
Of Watchmen.
There's about an hour and 20 minutes left to the movie.
Yeah. Man. I think we're right around the, for some reason, the sex scene on the Archie, on the owl ship. I feel like is around minute 100, somewhere in that region. So that would be like post prison break. Yeah, I'll go with that, but that might, yeah, I don't know.
Okay, just so you know, there you have 10 minutes till you get to the sex scene.
Okay.
So try and work your way backwards. Where okay. are we 10 minutes earlier?
So let's see. Prison break. Before that, we get... then it's probably scene with Dan and Lori in now. Well, I don't know. I'm wailing now. I'll put it in Dan's brownstone with Dan and Lori.
Nope. That okay. happens. That happens a few minutes after where we're at right now. This is the point yeah. where basically Rorschach is being interrogated.
Okay.
You know, where we have the
psychologist.
Line. Yes. Fate didn't okay. butcher her and destiny didn't feed her to those dogs. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I would have, yeah, I was thinking that was closer to the prison break, but I guess, yeah.
Yeah. I actually love the prison break scene. I think it's just amazing. Oh, yeah. It's one of the, I mean, the whole movie's great, but the prison break is one of my favorite scenes, especially because, you know, you have the character. I always think of him as Mickey from, Seinfeld, the character played by Danny Woodburn. He's just great there. I yeah. love the idea of what they did. In the comic, is it also played by, is it also a midget?
Yeah, definitely little person in the comic, although I don't, the way that the art is, you know, I don't know. Yeah, he's definitely drawn to be much smaller. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. All right. Great. Travis, do you want to, for one final time this season, let people know where they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, I'm working on Minute of Thieves, breaking down Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, 1 minute at a time. That's going very well. I'm having a lot of fun with that. So hopefully you'll be able to listen to that soon. And I should have been plugging this like early in the week because Rob did tell me that this was going to be released kind of the first week of October, I believe you said, mm-hmm. which would mean that Movies by Minutes Indianapolis is tomorrow. So if you're hearing this and you're in the Indianapolis area, you know, come on down, check out, I don't know what the best place to find information for that at this point. We'll probably get something on moviesbyminutes.com, But yeah, that's happening tomorrow as of this airing.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you were able to join us today before going off, you know, to you know, I mean, you're actually in Indianapolis. So for you, it's not that far.
Yeah, it's down the road from me. I'm exactly. the one putting this one together. This
you're
year.
The organizer with, this year.
You know, yes.
Of course.
With the help of a lot of other people, of course.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yep.
All right. Great. So hopefully everyone will be there and I'll see them online because Indianapolis yeah. is not down the block for me. So, All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So, Travis, thank you very much for joining me once again this season. And also thank you for the artwork. And I look forward to having you back next season.
It was my pleasure. And thank you for, you know, bringing Die Hard 2 back into my life. Because I didn't say this, but I actually really enjoyed this movie.
Oh, wow. I'm glad.
That makes me so happy. Been like the, oh, good, good. I feel like it always gets a bad rap of just being a bad movie, but I don't think it's a bad movie. So
I agree with you. It's not a bad movie.
Yeah.
Trust me, when we get to Die Hard 5, then we'll talk about bad movies. Yeah. All right, great. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest. So have a great weekend. Everyone enjoy yourselves in Indianapolis as you're meeting up and having a beer and some hot sauce and other things to burn your entire system out with Travis. But until Monday, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages,